Welcome back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and I remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. And remember, it is a credit union. It belongs to you. It ain't just an ordinary old bank. For information, www.mecu.com. And in the studio is a good guy, Richard
Thank
Vax,
you.
Professor of rhetoric at Towson University, who
two good guys
who wrote the book, the only authentic book of persuasion, The Salience Agenda, Meaning Spin Model, the only authentic book. 410-319-8888. As the only authentic book, Richard.
Well, let me tell you a little of the background of this. The field of rhetoric and persuasion has had books on persuasion and persuasion courses for decades and decades and decades. And there are well-known books of persuasion. And one of the authors of probably the most successful book of persuasion in the country is a very urbane guy, mm-hmm. until you disagree with him. Then he's not so urbane. You ever known people like that? People who are very clever and witty, and you think, boy, this guy never has a temper. But then when you disagree with them, you know, they're all of a sudden kind of nasty. And that's this guy. And I used to say to this guy, you know, when you write your book of persuasion, how come you never include what I've written over the decades in our field? And he said, I don't want to. He said, I'm not interested. You know, and then he said he wasn't interested in hearing my argument. Which is an interesting point for a guy who writes on persuasion, and so there are a couple books that did quote me and a couple books that didn't quote me, and I thought to myself, you know, I've been talking about this, and I've had a course at Towson that is empirically probably the most successful elective course in the university for decades, and I thought I should write a book on the articles I've written on persuasion and my perspective of persuasion, and also I'm correct, and nobody who talks about persuasion talks about it in quite this way, and so the only part of the title is correct, and I said the only authentic book of persuasion. Now, when I chose that title, there was in my thought that there's a little bit of tongue-in-cheek, but then when it became known throughout the field that I had a titled book, The Only Authentic Book of Persuasion, there were people who were wed to earlier theorists who got angry at me before they saw the book. They were saying, who's this guy to tell us what the only book of persuasion is? And I said, I guess I haven't persuaded you. You know?
But, so what's the difference between your theory of persuasion and the theory of the fellow who wouldn't put you in his book?
The theory of the fellow who wouldn't put me in the book is the theory which we call in rhetoric the rhetorical situation, which means that there are situational exigencies which create persuasion. In other words, whatever situation you're in, you read the situation, and the situation dictates what you can say and what you can't say. And I'm oversimplifying a little bit, but my argument is that there is no such thing as a situation, that people, agents, create the situation. They create what we talk about. They create what you want to make salient, you create the agenda. And after you create the agenda successfully for given audiences, you then fight for what it means. And that's part of the spin model. You fight for what it means. You fight for the spin of it. You fight for the significance. And so there are a billion examples of this. But when John McCain was running in 2008, and he never mentioned in the first couple debates Bill Ayers or Tony Rezko. That was a choice he made. He had the ability to make those issues salient, and he decided not to, and it hurt him. And now, what does it mean that Barack Obama was first friendly with Bill Ayers? Well, if you ask a Republican, it would say, well, it shows the shady kind of character that he had.
Or a closed-minded Republican.
But, right. That's an interesting – that's part of persuasion. That's right. You would say a closed-minded Republican.
Right. I would say that.
Right. And I'd say he's a Republican.
I mean, I know Bill Ayers, and he's a friend of mine.
Is that right?
Yes.
Well, okay. There you go. I'm sorry to hear that.
Bill Ayers is a great guy.
Well, and see, this is all rhetoric. I mean,
it's not rhetoric. It's truth.
But to say it's truth is rhetoric. In other words, you're trying to interpret what Bill Ayers means, and I'm trying to interpret what Bill Ayers means for my audience and for your audience. And so McCain doesn't mention Bill Ayers and Resco, and I think that's a choice of his, and I think it hurts him. And then when we talk about Bill Ayers, there are all kinds of interpretations as to what it means to be Bill Ayers, what it means to have been friendly with Bill Ayers, what it means to have gotten a loan from Tony Resco. And my brother, by the way, who is kind of a conservative Democrat, my brother says
– not too different than you.
I'm kind of a progressive Republican, you know.
Really?
But
well, that's another day. We'll go ahead.
That's another day, right? my brother says the Resco stuff is meaningless. It doesn't mean anything. So he's friends with Resco. So what? And I'll say to him, well, I think it's very significant. I think it's very significant that when you get a loan from a gangster, that it means that you are beholden to him, that you're in that system, that it shows something about your integrity. And my brother, whom I love and who he and I are very close, and he says, no, it means nothing. And I say, it means everything. Now, that's a rhetorical conflict. He says, what does it mean? He says, nothing. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't tell you anything about Barack Obama. I said, it tells you everything about Barack Obama. Now, who's right? I don't know, but that's what persuasion is all about.
410-319-8888. Get in on this rhetorical conversation about the art of persuasion. 410-319-8888. But what I don't understand is, I didn't understand, is it seems like neither school, your school, the school you were opposing, would see an interaction, a dialectic between the two.
Right.
That at times a situation can alter and change what you might say about a given situation.
And the concession I make to that point of view is that there are matters which, for example, physically impinge themselves on you. One of the examples I use in the book is that I say, you know, try punching a bully in the mouth and then talking about astrophysics with him. You know, there are physical events that impinge on our lives, that gain salience, that there's nothing you can't talk about something else. You know, I mean, you and I were talking about Ron Smith earlier. I mean, he has pancreatic cancer. Now, you know, that is a topic to him that you cannot simply say there's a struggle for agenda. I mean, that is a topic that is with him that he's got to deal with and that there's no escape from. There's no rhetorical escape within limits. There's no rhetorical escape to the topic. But even that topic you can debate the spin. You know,
what would be the spin?
Well, the spin is that on one hand, you could say this is a terrible event that a brilliant, brilliant, wonderful man faces his demise. On the other hand, you could say he is 69 years old. This faces all of us. You know, he's almost lived his 70. That he's had a wonderful life. I mean, God, could you imagine a better life than his? And this is what faces us all, and maybe mine's 5 years away, you know. And so it is in the scope of things, it is not that dramatic an event. Now, again, it's all debate on meaning and significance. But first the debate on what you talk about, then the debate on what it means. Agenda spin. And, you know, I could give you a million topics. My theory fascinates me.
That's good.
It is good. And my students for 37 years at Towson have loved it. They've all, I mean, this sounds terribly bragging, and I apologize if it is, but it is. And that is, I have probably had the most consistently high teaching evaluations at Towson, maybe than any other professor. And it's all due to this theory.
Well, maybe it's because you grade easily.
I don't.
I'm just teasing you.
But I'm glad you said that because I don't. I don't grade easily. Now, but by the way, everything is rhetoric. For example, you brought up grading, right? Now, you didn't have to bring up grading. You could have brought up grading. You could have brought up something else. You could have said, you know, maybe you just want to, you know, get along with your students. You know, there's a million things. Whatever you bring up, that's what you struggle for agenda. And then we struggle for meaning. Talk shows are all about rhetoric. What do you talk about? What does it mean? You know, it's interesting. I'm probably one of the few people that I'm both a presence on WBL and I'm a presence on your show. It is fascinating to me to hear topics discussed on your show and then on WBL or WBL and then on your show. It's like you're in two different universes. And there's a difference in topics to some extent, and there's a diametrically opposed difference in spin. I mean, the obviousness to you and your audience of certain interpretations of issues, and the obviousness of WBAL's talk show hosts and the meaning of some events to them and the events to them. I mean, it's fascinating to experience one show and then the opposite show. And I, you know, I would suggest to anybody that they listen at times to both you and WBAL, because you are obviously an exceptionally bright guy. You know, so is Ron Smith, an exceptionally bright guy. We were talking earlier about you know, the missed opportunity of having debates between Mark Steiner and Ron Smith. Imagine what a fascinating debate that could be. I mean, I would pay money to hear that one.
So I'm curious, when you wrote this book,
yeah,
why you only used the pictures of Barack Obama?
Because he's president.
Come on.
Now, well, but in fact, that's why because he's president. And the insert is to show in a State of the Union address. You could argue the State of the Union is strong. You could argue the State of the Union is not strong. You have a choice of topics to talk about. The war to defeat al-Qaeda. Employment numbers up. Unemployment percentage too high. Government spending. Tax policy. Which do you want to talk about? Which, when people debate the deficit, which do they want to talk about? They want to talk about the fact that they want to talk about tax policy. They want to talk about government spending. You know, in foreign policy, you want to talk about Iran. You want to talk about Syria. You want to talk about Israel. There are choices of what to talk about and what it means. And it is all in the fascinating world of persuasion and rhetoric.
So part of this book – a couple of things struck me here.
Yeah.
A lot of things struck me in this book. But it seemed that you have certain things that are part of the cornerstone of your belief system.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I do.
And one that we don't agree with. A couple of them probably.
Yeah,
But that's right.
But there's some liberal concessions in here too.
But you used a lot of this book to kind of use your arguments about rhetoric to advance your arguments about mental illness.
Yeah, I do. Because mental illness is a perfect example.
I mean, no matter what, when you ever come on my show, you always want to figure out a way to bring the issue of mental illness up. Do you know that? No matter what the topic is.
But I didn't bring it up there. You brought it up.
I brought it up this time.
Because you're my bud. I assume that's why you brought it up. Yeah, the issue of mental illness. Look. Fred hits John in the face, okay? Smash him in the face and takes his money, all right? Why does he do it? Why does he do it? And why I talk about it. But let's say we've agreed on that topic. Well, you know, a psychiatrist comes in and says, well, you know, Fred hit John in the face because he couldn't help it. And you say, and I say, well, what do you mean he couldn't help it? Well, Fred has a compulsive disorder to punch people in the face and take their money. Now, That's an interesting bit of rhetoric. That's now you say, well, why do you think that? You say, because he has mental illness. You say, well, what's the evidence of his mental illness? Well, I'm an expert. I'm a psychiatrist. I have a medical degree, and therefore I can tell you that this is an example of mental illness. And I say, well, I think he punched him in the face to take his money because he needed his money. And the doctor says, well, you know, you're wrong. How do we know you're wrong? Because you're not a doctor. So you're mystified to the point where you accept that explanation. That's an interpretation of why John hit Fred. The example of the Norway killer, Breivik. Oh, he's now been adjudged to be insane. Now, he killed 77 people, and he meticulously planned it. Now, why would anybody interpret that as being illness?
But what does that have to do with your arguments about rhetoric?
Because it has to do with the interpretation of the event of a person killing 77 people. He kills 77 people, all right? We fight for that as a topic. All right, that's what we're talking about. Then the psychiatrists come along in Norway and say – two psychiatrists come along in Norway. I want to be pretty precise on this. And they say, you know, Breivik killed 77 people. And by the way, liberals should really like this point, because this guy is against multiculturalism. That's why he says he killed 77 people.
Right.
So psychiatrist says that isn't why he killed 77 people. He killed 77 people because he either can't control himself or he doesn't understand what he did.
Why can't both be true?
Well, I guess it could be true. But why not believe Occam's razor? Why not believe he killed 77 people who were on a, I don't know what they were on, liberal outings or something, and he assumed that they were in favor of multiculturalism, and he killed them because he's an evil person.
You have to believe in the notion of evil, which I'm sure that most people do, which I don't necessarily believe in. But
yeah, I believe in evil.
You believe in evil?
I absolutely believe.
You believe
in
that certain people are inherently evil?
No, I believe that there are people who choose to commit evil acts.
What makes a person evil then? What creates evil in a human being?
I think there are people who make choices that are self-indulgent, that are—
How they make those choices? You don't think those choices are affected at all by any kind of outside forces? It's all something you conjure up your own inside?
I believe that people grow up and they have influence on their lives, but I think the outcome is their choice. I believe in agency. I believe that people choose what they do.
And you think that's completely under their control and nothing can influence that unconsciously, subconsciously, or consciously cannot manipulate or control or determine what and how you think?
You give me a false dilemma there because I don't—
It's not a false dilemma. It's a real dilemma.
Let me say why I think it's a false dilemma, because I do believe that people are influenced by events in their life, but they then choose their actions.
But you don't think that those events affect how one may choose their actions?
Let me concede that. Let me say that if I had been brought up with different parents and in a different place in society, literally, if a different geographical place, that I might have tended toward different behaviors, but it would still be my choice. It's my choice whether to – we assume that when a – excuse me. We assume when a person becomes an adult.
Can't your choices are often limited by the situation that you're in or affected by the situation you're in? If you are
affected, yes, affected, yes. But here's where we're at, counting angels on a pin. Do I believe that people are affected by their upbringing? I do. Do I believe people as adults are responsible for their choices? I do. Now, do you find that inconsistent?
Yes.
Why? To
because
argue that people,
I think that I think you don't have. That's what I was thinking about. This argument you're making.
Okay.
And that's why I thought at the end of your book you were kind of using your arguments about the nature of rhetoric to justify your belief that there is no such thing as mental illness.
Okay. But let me just say parenthetically, there are a number of liberal concessions throughout the book on liberal policy, which I apply the theory to. But go ahead.
You do. Which is why you thought I would like the book.
No, I thought you'd like the book because the theory is consistent. That is why I thought you'd like the book.
I was just teasing you. But I think we don't agree on the notion of mental illness.
Right.
I mean,
right.
We do agree on
brain disease. In other words, I do believe that if you go to a psychiatric ward, and you see a person who is sitting, singing to himself. People have brain disease. There are people with brain disease, and there are non-goal directed actions which typify people who have brain disease. And the brain is an organ; it can be diseased. But when people commit acts that,
I give an example. I think there are. There's enough evidence that people who consume a lot of lead paint have a tendency towards violence. Enough studies to prove that. And that means that it's not totally up to a personal choice about how you behave, that you have been altered by the environment around you. I think that people are altered by their emotionally by the environment around them. If you are part of an abusive household, an abusive, dangerous neighborhood, your responses are going to be determined in part, by the surroundings that affected you as a child. And so that's why I don't agree that you have complete free choice. Sometimes you have to have free choice only after a series of treatments, whether it's time incarcerated, if you're in a place that actually treats you, or if you've gone through therapy, or if you work through things, at a certain point in your life, you can wrestle with things and come out the other side. But I don't think that this whole Western notion of complete free choice, I think, is more political rhetoric than it is than anything to do with what really motivates and pushes human beings.
If you believe that people brought up in a desperate environment lose their freedom of choice, how do you account?
I didn't say lose. I never said lose. Okay. I said that it affects, and maybe even I might use the word limits, but affects their freedom of choice.
How do you account for the fact that most people brought up in any environment tend to be law-abiding people?
I don't even know what that means. I mean, I think that that people can channel, let's say, their violent responses in any number of ways. For whatever reason, the existence you lived brought violence as a part of your life, it was bred into you in some senses, you may take that out on somebody on the street. You may just take it out by kicking a dog. You may take it out, and you may be an abusive boss. You may be a verbally abusive boss, a verbally abusive spouse. Those things are all connected to me. So you don't have to say, and some people, because of the situation they're in, end up breaking a law. So I think law breaking is an incorrect response to how to describe the situation.
Let's stipulate that we're talking about adults, okay? We're stipulating that we're talking about adults, all right? Adults can choose to do what they wish. When two people are brought up in a compromised, violent background, let's say single parents, okay? And let's say they're in an area in which there's violence all around them. And one person chooses in his adulthood or her adulthood not to be violent, and the other chooses to be violent. Why isn't that a clear example of choice?
Because I think a lot of things affect those decisions, and it's not just about the individual's choice. It could be that one person had help from another group of people that was affected by a teacher, by a counselor, by anybody in their lives who helps nurture somebody in a different way of life. People don't live in vacuums like that, Richard. That's not how existence works.
But people who believe as you do work backwards. They say, we had X behavior, therefore let's go into that person's history to ascertain how it was created. I say a person may have X background, but at the time of behavioral decisions, they have control by their agency to make those decisions.
And I'm saying no. I'm saying that choice is not that simplistic.
All right, let's say that these two points of view are irreconcilable.
And folks,
right?
You know, can join us. We have like 5 or 10 minutes left. 410-319-8888. Is Rick Vatz, the rhetorician, correct or not?
By the way, it's rhetorician, not rhetorician. Rhetoricians are people who bury rhetoricians.
Is that what I'll be? No. It was like what my daughter said to me the other day when I said something about one of my grandkids who popped out blonde-haired and blue-eyed, even though both his parents were darker-skinned. And I said, regressive genes, amazing. He looked at me and went, Dad, no, it's recessive genes. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Wisdom from a 14-year-old.
I could have made that mistake.
But, a lot of people calling in here, so let's try to get some callers in before the end of the hour. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Paul, you're on the air. Hi, Paul, you're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to kind of say to your guest, I do agree with what you say about choice when somebody, no matter what you come through, just my father was born and grown up in a horribly violent family system where everybody was beaten on a daily basis, and he's been one of the greatest parents I could imagine to me. He's never laid a hand on me, never even raised his voice that much. It's just when you do get older, you have the choice to break the cycle, break the pattern of violence that you're brought up in, or you go along with it. You have the choice to do that. And whether or not somebody comes into your life, whether it's Jesus, a mentor, or not, ultimately you have the choice to listen to that mentor and take their advice, or you have the evil inside which will go against their advice.
Let me just say parenthetically, this is the first time in the decades I've been on with Mark that a call has ever supported me so completely.
That's not true.
Yes,
it is. Absolutely untrue.
No, it isn't.
Rick, that's absolutely untrue.
It's absolutely
untrue.
It's true.
Maybe your last few experiences here have been that way, but that is absolutely untrue.
I'm sorry. This is empirically determined. And thank you, caller. I appreciate it because you and I are on the same wavelength.
Thank you, Paul. 410-319-8888.
So you get rid of him because he agrees with me.
We only have a few minutes. We get some callers in.
Okay.
He's just so paranoid.
I just was
wondering. Candace, you're on the air. Hi, Candace. You're on the air.
Hi. Okay. So I was saying that even though I agree with both of you in some type of part, but me personally, I think that even though you have grown up in a childhood that was violent, it's still ultimately your choice if you want to treat other people in violence or if you want to start some type of club or agency or something to stop violence in a certain area.
Well, let me just say, two in a row, Mark, what is going on here? Is this a setup?
No, it's not, because I think people believe in the notion of free choice. I think that's a popular belief system, and that you're espousing. I think that I'm not surprised.
I have articulated comparable views in the past, and I've never had two straight calls supporting me.
Well, wait a minute, Candace, I appreciate your thoughts, and let's see if Nicole supports what you're saying. Nicole, you're on the air.
I don't necessarily agree. I've seen there are people, for example, some of the examples that you gave, that can supersede their upbringing and make the choice to do things differently. But, you know, I work in the field of psychology, and you don't have to be a psychologist to know that, you know, people imitate what's around them. And the biggest challenge that I have, because I'm one of the people that is a mentor that works with children, and so sometimes some of the things, the patterns and learned behaviors don't always fit in with, you know, the social norms and the social cues. And so that's what we, you know, that's where we come in. So if it was just that simple, I wouldn't have a job. And it's really tough, really, really tough to even break through to the one or two. And I've been in the field for about 20 years, and, you know, I'm one of the few that hasn't been burnt out. But it's really tough trying to teach if you come from a background where violence is acceptable. If you come from a background where breaking the law is acceptable, it's a long process. Because when you think about it, I gave this shot at 13, so I have to basically undo 13 years worth of what they've learned. And then if, you know, the loving relationship is still there, basically I'm telling you, to a 13-year-old, your parents aren't any good. They were stupid. They taught you everything wrong. You know, of course, as an adult, we don't see it that way. But a child, you know, me trying to tell you that, no, your parents are wrong, even if they come from the worst of the worst background, you know, so I don't necessarily agree. I do believe that there are the few, like I said, they do succeed, right, and they do make different choices.
Before we have to go to break, let me let Rick respond.
Well, first of all, I do believe that it is difficult to overturn a consistent background of violence. But, you know, even with kids, and I had stipulated we were talking about adults, but even with kids, if a kid commits violence, let's say that we do not believe that the person has, in a philosophical sense, the same order of responsibility as an adult. But my concern for victims always supersedes my concern for perpetrators. There are people who want to jump and say, this individual is not responsible for what he or she did. And I say that if you cannot make – let's assume you cannot make the determination of responsibility. Then I think – The assumption ought to be that your concern is for protection of a victim. And so therefore, if a 13-year-old commits murder, I to be honest with you, depending upon the type of murder, I would not have any difficulty in seeing that 13-year-old incarcerated for life.
Oh my God.
I'm sorry.
We have to take a break, and I have no room now to come back at you, which is not fair.
Well, I think that's how it's working tonight.
I think that is so off base, but I love you anyway, Vats.
I love you too.
Richard Vats, Professor Richard Vats, Taos University. The book is The Only Authentic Book of Persuasion, The Salience Agenda, Meaning Spin Model. It's a textbook, but a good book.
Thank you.
And Richard, it was fun.
It was.
We have to take a brief break and we'll come back. Lines are jammed. Agrees with guest. Choice conditioned by context. Freedom of choice. Agree with guest. Choice as an adult.
What a night.
See that?
You're doing this because you're my bud.
let me read this before we go out of here. So, it's that time of year for our annual WEAA Members Only Appreciation Holiday Party. Thursday, December the 1st, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Black Olive in Baltimore. Enjoy complimentary cuisine and special live broadcast performance featuring Marshall Booze and the MC Booze Band. You must be a current WEAA member to attend, and space is limited. So you better call 443-885-2075. That's 443-885-2075 to reserve your place. The special event is brought to you by the Black Olive and Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'll be right back.